Here we go. We are beginning a Torah portion next that starts in Deuteronomy chapter 16, about halfway through verse 18. And this one is called Shoftim, because that's how it begins, as you probably already figured out. It says Shoftim, that means judges and officers. Shoftim and officers you shall have in your gates. You'll make them in your gates, which Yahuwah Eloheka gives you. Tribe by tribe, and it says here, they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. Mishpat Zedek. That word Zedek or Zadek, remember Zadek means a righteous one. Zedek is essentially the concept of righteousness. You got that same root word in there. Zadi, Dalet, and then the Kof. Kind of in English like a ZDK. And you put different vowel pointers and things in there, different suffixes on it, and you get variations on the same word. But it all has to do with judgment or righteousness, and those two things really go together. Verse 19 says, you shall not wrest judgment, nor be a respecter of persons, nor take a gift, a bribe, because a bribe or a gift, and ultimately, I think it's interesting here too, this word, a bribe, isn't quite as hardcore, maybe the way to put it, as we think. In other words, you don't have to be Hillary Clinton or, a federal judge on the take to be talking about a bribe. Literally, Rashi points out here that when it repeats it this way, it is essentially saying that even if it's just payment for services rendered and not what we today might call a bribe, that still tends to pervert the words of the righteous. So, in general, the sages take a harder line on this idea of bribery and what's being talked about here, saying that anything above the money that a person would otherwise earn, in other words, if they have to take time off from what it is that puts food on the table in order to perform judgment, well, they certainly the workman is worth his hire. But beyond that, then we got a problem. Now, the next line is the one that I usually tend to focus on. And honestly, folks, if you gather from what I was saying during the course of the some of the readings that we do in the first part of the service, I look at the news and it just irritates the living you-know-what out of me. And this verse, I think, is at the heart of it. It says the following. Imagine if this actually still had anything to do with America in the 21st century. Zedek, Zedek, justice, justice, you shall pursue, so that you may live and inherit the land which Yahuwah Eloheka is given you. When something like that is repeated twice, it does a number of things. It emphasizes it. Some say even that there's a different nuance in the understanding when it's repeated twice. But one thing I will tell you for sure, we ain't got a clue what the hell that means in America anymore. Justice, justice, you shall follow. We got people running for president, folks, that shouldn't be outside of an orange jumpsuit. And that's the least of it. I mean, it's just beyond the pale how far gone things are. We'll talk a little bit about this in the news tonight. But I want to mention this one. This is a story that I literally just saw as I was fixing to get ready to go to the meal that we eat late on Erev Shabbat, just before we come up here. So I looked at the news, see if there was anything of late that had happened, and I saw this piece. And I thought, wow, I have to pull that out. Normally, I don't do news during this part of the Torah portion, because we got to get through quite a bit of information here. But I think this fits. We've just talked about how it's important that we have tzedek, people that can do righteous judgment. They're going to be before Yahuwah. He's going to give them to those who, well, I guess are deserving of it, who seek to follow after justice, justice, so that we might live and inherit the land. Well, we've been kicked out of the land for cause. Looks to me like we're fixing to get kicked out of this land too for cause. And listen to this. Here's the story that I picked up on. Barry Sabarco, Barry Sotero, Obamas the First, whatever the hell the name of the guy is, who put his hand on the Bible and lied and lied and lied and has literally perverted justice, destroyed the rule of law, and done everything possible, in other words, to take a formerly free country and turn it into one of the worst tyrannies the world has ever seen. We're still working on it, But trust me, we're getting there. And today we see this. Abid Qureshi has now been appointed by Barry Sabarco to be the first Muslim judge ever appointed to the federal bench by any president in the history of the formerly free republics. Yes, this is a Pakistani immigrant. He has practiced what is called law in the United States. He has never been a judge. He has no record to inspect. However, it seems pretty clear because he's been hailed by the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the variations of the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas terrorist organizations, that he is a major proponent of Sharia law. And trust me, folks, if you've ever read the Quran and if you'll read the Torah, you will see that these things have not very much to do with one another. Because the concept of Sharia law is unlike just about everything we're going to go through this evening. And if you don't believe that, sit down and compare them side by side. But I'll talk about some of the things as we go through it here. Suffice it to say that justice you shall pursue, uh-uh. And righteous judges, we haven't got any. I mean, seriously, we're to the point where if there's a righteous judge, I'm thinking of a fellow that was killed and then there was no autopsy done. You might remember that particular case. Didn't get much waste stream coverage. What was the guy's name? Oh yeah, Antonin Scalia. Seems like once upon a time he read the Constitution. There was a time when people basically understood that, what was the concept? We have rights that come from God. The purpose of government is to secure those rights, to protect them. That's why, laws are implemented in accord with the supreme law and in accord, therefore, with Deuteronomy, among other things. How far have we come? We've come to the place now where not only are atheist judges considered just fine, and the only litmus test that really seems to matter for the Supreme Court is, how do you feel about the sacrament of Molech sacrifice and bloodying the land? There are some other ones too. If you like to pervert justice, if you can be bought, it's hard not to be downright sarcastic. Justice you shall pursue. Well, I'm just going to suggest to you, not anymore. Now, you know what's really interesting to me? The very next verse, after it talks about justice you shall pursue, says the following. Don't you go planting any Asherah trees beside the altar of Yahuwah, which you shall make, nor set up a pillar which he hates. In other words, don't do anything pagan. Isn't it funny that right after saying justice you shall pursue, he talks again about idolatry. And what is happening in the United States? We've got justices and judges that are not only not righteous, do not believe in the God of the Bible, do not pursue His justice, they don't even bother to read the Constitution that they swear to uphold in 99.9% of the cases. Here we are. All right. I'm going to take a deep breath because it's hard to compare what's going on in the world with what should go on in the world according to Torah and not think, oh, for crying out loud. Chapter 17 of Deuteronomy talks about not sacrificing unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh things that are blemished, not quite right. An ox or a sheep or anything with a blemish. That is, it says, an abomination, a blot, a stain unto Yahuwah. And furthermore, if they're found in the midst of your gates, anyone, man or woman, that does something which is evil in the sight of Yahuwah Eloheka in transgressing His covenant, and they've gone and worshipped other gods, like the moon god, it actually says that here, gods of the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I've commanded you not to, and you find out about it, you're to inquire diligently, and behold, if it's true, and the thing is certain, that such an abomination has been wrought in the land, then you bring forth that man or woman that's done this evil thing, and you shall stone them with stones. Well, obviously, again, we've been kicked out of the land for cause. So you say, well, this doesn't necessarily apply, and for crying out loud, it can't. Because if somebody worships the moon god or the host of heaven and is basically doing things that are abominations and saying, go serve other gods, well, they get to be nominated to the federal bench. They get to run for president and do Molech sacrifices in the Oval Office. Ah. At the mouth of two or three witnesses, persons that do this kind of thing, things that condemn them to death, will be put to death. You must have more than one witness, not just a single witness, it says. And furthermore, the hand of those witnesses are the first that are to be raised against the person who is guilty of some crime deserving of death. This is how you put away the evil from the midst of you. Again, clearly, Israel was kicked out of the land. We're not there anymore. And I look at the situation today and say, are we even moving in the right direction? Hell no. If there arises a matter that's too hard for you in judgment, between blood and blood, plea and plea, stroke and stroke, in other words, things that just look too difficult, then you go to the place that Yahuwah shall choose, come before the priests, the Levites, or the judges that'll be in whatever days this is, and inquire. And they will declare the sentence of the judgment. And it says you are to do according to the tenor of that sentence. Observe to do all that they teach you. Listen to verse 11. According to the Torah. Now, the English here says law, but we know that law is not the correct translation, really. We talk about statutes, judgments, and commandments, but this word is Torah. It's instruction. What else are they teaching? They're teaching his instruction. And according to the judgment, now there's that word mishpat, which they shall tell you. That's what you're supposed to do. Don't turn aside, neither to the right hand nor the left. And the man that does presumptuously and not hearkening into the priest that stands to minister before Yahuwah or unto the judge, that person is guilty of a crime unto death. That's how you exterminate the evil from Israel. People should hear and fear and don't do any such thing presumptuously anymore. We are working our way through a whole list of things, which I'm going to suggest to you. This is where I pause and say, okay, you know what? As irritating in some respects as it is to go through the Torah and see just how abused it is, how literally, no wonder, you know, people say, oh, the law is done away with, nailed to the cross. Well, the idiots that lie like that, and the truth is not in them, have long since convinced people, you know, no wonder the United States is in such a mell of a hass. We don't have a supreme law. It's not worth the paper it's printed on. You've got judges that don't even acknowledge that there is any power greater than them. They look in the mirror, they see God. And they think they can rewrite it. And the Constitution is just a set of guidelines. And the Bill of Rights that says thou shalt not means, well, you know, that's for the peons. Hitler is above the law. We got other news stories we'll do tonight. Everybody is above the law except for the peons out there in the hinterlands and flyover country. The law applies to them. Seems like that's going to be in this week's Torah portion too. We've come a long way, baby, to get where we've got to today. We've got our own cigarette, but we don't have any more law. If you don't remember, that's the Benson and Hedges commercial from many, many years ago. When you have come into the land, says verse 14, that Yahuwah gives you, and you possess it, and you dwell in there, and then eventually there may come a time when you'll say, hey, I'd like to have a king, like all the other nations round about. And you remember the story. This is one of those recorded votes in Scripture where democracy again shows itself to be a failure. 1 Samuel chapter 8, where the people finally said, yeah, we want a king like all the other nations. You know the story. The prophet Samuel was told by God, nope, they have not rejected you, Samuel. They've rejected me for being king over them. Tell them, warn them what they're going to get. He did. They didn't listen. They got Saul. But listen to some things that indicate that, you know, Saul looks pretty good compared to Ahab or compared to Obamas, the ones we have today, or the ones that are running. If you set a king over you, and it's one that Yahuwah shall choose, it is to meet the following criteria. It is to be someone from among your brethren that you set over you. Do not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. And I look at the situation and say, hey, can we not see clearly what kind of a problem that results in? You put somebody there that does not worship the same God, does not respect the law of the nation, does not respect the people thereof, does not respect truth or anything else that was once called justice in the American way. Yeah. What can you say other than, yeah, Creator, Elohim, you were right. We did the evil deed. Yeah, yeah. Who knows where? Who knows where the whatever it is that's in there was born. Now, it's also interesting. I mentioned there's a bunch of stuff in here that's politically incorrect, and of course that's part of the problem. If you take the things that the Creator says do, and to also take the things He says don't do, and you say no, whatever He says don't do, we're going to mandate. Whatever He says do, we could care less about. We get into a problem, and eventually it becomes politically incorrect even to suggest that something He says is important still matters. So I want to list to the next few things that have to do with this king. Now, if you remember the history of the American Revolution, one of the slogans was "No king, but King Jesus." They didn't like King George III, who looks like a pretty decent guy. I think I would trade King George III for just about anybody we've had for quite a while. All he did was tax without representation and do a few warrantless searches and basically things that are now considered part and parcel of the American way. So the king is to not do three things. First, he is not to basically do things that put himself in a different class than his brethren. Remember, he's supposed to be one of the people. So he's not to multiply three things. Not to multiply horses to himself. Well, you know, he can have a few horses, have a stable full even, ride when he wants to, maybe hitch him up to a wagon or a chariot. That's okay. But not multiply. Don't get inordinate numbers of them. And in particular, not enough that the people might decide that they've got enough horses to go back to Egypt, back into bondage. Do not return anymore this way. Furthermore, he is not to multiply wives to himself. Now, the key word here is multiply. And honestly, there's a difference between adding wives and multiplying wives. You read scripture, you see David had something on the order of 13, maybe 17 wives. He was called a man after Elohim's own heart. He was given Saul's wife, the book tells us. And that was certainly adding wives. And none of that was a problem. It was a problem when he went out and had to have one that he's not supposed to have had because she was somebody else's wife. Her name was Bathsheba. You know the story. So that was a bad thing. But it wasn't the fact that he had more than one. Somewhere along the line, though, you get to his son Solomon, who had hundreds. And in between a dozen and hundreds, I think we crossed the line into multiplying. Now, what I think is funny is you go back through history, you can look at people like Henry VIII. You can look at most of the history of the British Empire, and indeed all of the kings of Europe, and for that matter, most of the kings everywhere. And you see that when it comes to breaking all of these instructions, we didn't get to the third one, but he's not to greatly multiply silver and gold. A little bit, a lot even, is okay. It doesn't just say multiply, it says greatly multiply silver and gold. So he can be wealthy. He's just not supposed to be filthy, stinking rich, evidently. And again, when it comes to almost all of these things, we've seen kings throughout history break these principles and essentially elevate themselves to the point where A, a lot of them aren't of their brothers, and B, they certainly aren't one of the peons. They even call themselves special names like blue bloods, destined to rule. It's a whole different attitude than what Torah says. Finally, that brings me to this last one. Now, listen to this and ask yourself, wow, wouldn't it be cool if even a little bit of this concept still survived? It shall be, it says. And by the way, they did this for a long time. I guarantee you, David understood this principle. It shall be that when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, he is to write himself out a copy of this Torah on his own sefer, on his own scroll, out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. In other words, you go to the Levites and say, let me get the official archive copy of the Torah. I'm on. Do what I'm supposed to do. Copy it out in my own hand. That's a pretty tall order. Why? Well, because it says in the next verse, it shall be with him. He is to read therein all the days of his life. Can you imagine if we even had a president that had ever read the Bible? for crying out loud that thought it might be important? Or even, this is a lot shorter, easier task. How about if he just made a copy of a bit of the Constitution, like, say, the 10 easy parts of the Bill of Rights? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the right of people to assemble and blah, 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 or the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Or how about TSA groping people and raping their rights in airports without bothering with warrants or probable cause? Wouldn't it be cool if any part of this Torah still applied to the man and women who would be king, who would rule over everybody else? Just a little bit. The reason why the king was supposed to copy a version, literally in his own hand of the Torah, was so that he could read it, and, as it says here in verse 19, that he might learn to fear Yahuwah Eloheka. We got a president now that's wanting to put people in as shoftim who don't even serve. No! Yahuwah Eloheka, and obviously he doesn't either. Much less keep all the words of this Torah and these statutes to do them. And it tells us the following thing. So that his heart might not be lifted up above his brethren, and of course we don't have one of those anyway, that he doesn't turn aside from the commandments, not to the right nor to the left, so that he might prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Well, again, we're so far from this one that you can't even see it from here. Chapter 18 talks about the priests, the Levites, tribe of Levi. They don't have... Pardon? Question? Oh, okay. Thought I heard a question. Okay. I guess there's other questions, but I didn't see that one. Okay. Priests, the Levites, even all of the tribes have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They are to eat the offerings of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh made by fire. That's his inheritance there. So, for that reason, because they have no inheritance among their brethren, and he is, in fact, their inheritance, this is the priest's due. When someone offers a sacrifice, korban, ox, sheep, they'll give to the priest the shoulder, the two cheeks, and the maw, also the first fruits of the corn, the wine, the oil, the first of the fleece of the sheep. All of those things are the due of the Levites, the priests. For Yahuwah has chosen these folks out of all of the tribes to stand to minister in the name of Yahuwah, him and his sons, forever. And if a Levite comes from up out of all Israel, the place that he is told to go, he shall minister in the name of Yahuwah, his Elohim, as all his brethren, the Levites, do, who stand before Yahuwah. They shall have like portions to eat, besides that which is due in their father's houses. So basically the idea is we're going to take care of these folks who are doing the work of Yahuwah. When you've come into the land which Yahuwah gives you, oh, have we heard this before? Don't! Repeat, do not, and here it is repeated again, do not learn to do after the abominations that all of those nations do. This gets repeated over and over and over again. There's not to be found among you anyone that makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, someone that uses divination, a soothsayer, an enchanter, or a sorcerer or charmer, consulting ghosts or familiar spirits or a necromancer. Whoever does these things is an abomination unto Yahuwah. But in the United States, they run for president. And because of these abominations, Yahuwah is driving those people out from before you. Ironically, folks, now we're in a land that is literally rife with them. You shall be wholehearted with Yahuwah Eloheka. These nations that you're dispossessing, they do these things that are abominations. They hearken to soothsayers, diviners, but you're not supposed to do that. Yahuwah has not suffered you to do so. Instead, it tells us something here. Now, this is one of these prophecies that certainly points to the coming of the Mashiach, to the Torah made flesh. A prophet, says Moses, who Yahuwah, your El, will raise up from the midst of you. He too is to be among your brethren. He comes from the tribes that you know. And says Moses, he will be like unto me. And to him you shall hearken, hear and obey. Now what's interesting, if you look at the sages, and this is one of those things where I kind of thought it was true, but now I've seen some confirmation. Other folks have looked through and they concur. This is the only place in the whole Torah where Moshe describes himself as a prophet. Interesting. Now, clearly there are things that he does that would qualify him in that regard, but this is the only place, as far as I can recall, and again, there are witnesses that seem to say this is true, where he self-describes as a prophet and then refers to one like unto me that'll be raised up. According to all that you did desire in Horeb on the day of the assembly from Yahuwah, remember? Y'all said, don't again let me hear the voice of Yahuwah, nor see this great fire, because I'm scared to death. I don't want to die. So that was essentially what they said. And if you remember the story, Yahuwah said, that's a pretty decent idea. We will do that. In other words, verse 17 repeats it this way. That which you have spoken is well said. So, he continues, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto you, Moshe. I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them, all that I command him. And it'll come to pass that whoever will not hearken to my words, what I'll have him speak in my name, I will require it of him. But as to these other prophets, another Jesus, as Paul puts it, or all kinds of little Christs that will come saying, I am this or that. They speak presumptuously, and those which speak something which I have not commanded him to speak, or those that speak in the name of other so-called gods, Elohim, those same folks, that prophet shall die. So Moshe asks the question. People are probably thinking, hey, wait a minute, how are we going to know? What if you say in your heart, how will we know what things Yahuwah has spoken and what he hasn't spoken? Well, says Moshe, and by the way, he gives this advice here, other places, like we just talked about Deuteronomy 13 last week, if they come preaching other gods, you know darn well they're liars and the truth is not in them. Anyway, he says it this way too, when a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, says that he is speaking, thus spoke Yahuwah, if it doesn't happen, if it doesn't come to pass, and it's something which he has not spoken, therefore, that prophet has spoken presumptuously. Don't be afraid of him. Now, there's one more obvious question. We don't get an easy answer to this one. How about if, like Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, others, how about if he, or Dave, Daniel, how about if he speaks something, even Moshe, if you recall, Moshe spoke things that would happen after the people were in the land, long after Moshe was gone. In other words, how about if a prophet speaks something that's going to happen in the distant future? Well, you don't know until we get to the distant future. And, of course, how distant is the distant future? So it's important, in other words, that we have other tests as well. And I will contend that while if something – that's part of the reason why, when it comes to a date certain, I tend to look askance at a prophet that says the earth will end on Tuesday the 12th of November. Well, at least come the 12th of November, you'll know whether he was right or not. Meanwhile, there are other tests, and the easier test is if some prophet claims to speak in the name of Yah and speaks things that are contrary to his own word and speaks of worshiping other gods whom neither you nor your fathers have known, is the way it's phrased, then you know darn well. Not only is he not a prophet, he does not speak for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, he is in fact deserving of death. Chapter 19, when Yahuwah cuts off these nations in the land that he is giving to you, and you succeed them, and you dwell in their cities and their houses, then you're to do the following. Now, we've talked about this before, too. This is another repetition. Separate these cities of refuge, three of them first. Prepare the way, divide the borders of the land, and into three parts. This is a place where the manslayer can flee. And essentially, without going through all the details of the manslayer, understand that there is a big difference, and it's outlined in some detail here, between someone who kills an individual accidentally, the manslayer, and someone who is, in fact, a murderer in the first degree. Murder with malice aforethought, premeditation, you name it. So we get some indications of exactly how this is laid out. I think most of us probably have heard enough about this kind of concept to have a pretty good idea. Someone who kills his neighbor unawares didn't hate him in times past. In other words, he doesn't have an obvious motive for wanting this fellow dead. And then he gives some examples. How about if he goes into a neighbor, they're cutting down a tree, but the axe handle flies off. Uh-oh! Oh, man! Hits him in the head and he dies. Well, that's the kind of place, that's the kind of situation where this city of refuge is appropriate. Because somebody, you killed my brother, you dirty rat, might decide to go after the person who is guilty of manslaying, but without malice aforethought. And so then the manslayer is to run to this city, lest the avenger of blood pursue him while his heart is hot and overtake him and smite him mortally, even if he's not deserving of death. So, says Yahuwah, I command you therefore, separate these cities. And then when he enlarges your borders, well, you can have three more cities. They'll be added besides the original three, with this idea at purpose, that innocent blood is not shed in the midst of the land, which Yahuwah gives you for an inheritance, so that that blood would be upon you. Now, I look at this again, and I go back and I say, justice, justice, you shall prefer. Shoftim, you're to have. The concept that keeps coming back and coming back throughout this portion is about understanding the difference between right and wrong, guilt and innocence. What constitutes real murder and what constitutes manslaughter? And what is the purpose of being concerned that innocent blood not be shed? Because it literally pollutes the land and that blood is upon you. You kind of see where I might be headed on this score, right? It's pretty obvious. We live in a land that is not just polluted with blood, it's flowing with it. It celebrates it. It considers it a sacrament to a whole different God. Again, it's the singular test that really matters to see whether someone in a pagan land should be qualified to put on the black robes of another God and say, hey, what part of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and the law of God do we intend to rape today? Let's decide whatever God says thou shalt not do and we'll mandate it. We'll say you have to like it. You got to support it. Hell, we'll subsidize it. So that the land not be polluted with innocent blood. All right, the portion then goes on to say, look, let's make this clear. If a man hates his neighbor, lies in wait for him, rises up against him, and then smites him so that he dies, nope, these cities are not for him. I think that should be clear. Furthermore, don't remove your neighbor's landmark that's been around since old time. In other words, don't commit various crimes that amount to theft by various names. And then it repeats this concept. And this is really key. It's kind of sort of how we're going to begin to connect the dots here with this idea of justice, justice, you shall pursue. And compare this to what's happened to the formerly free United States. One witness is not enough to rise up against a man for iniquity. Now, bear in mind, folks, we don't have any witnesses anymore. You got cameras that will convict somebody, click, click, of breaking something which isn't even a law, but hey, we'll fine you anyway. We don't need no stinking witness. You have a right to see the evidence against you in a court of law? Well, we don't have courts of law. We have courts of opinion and bribery and where money is what matters. And it's not even real money. It's just currency. But if this mattered, well, what it says is it's not enough to have one witness to rise up against a man for any iniquity or any sin. It's at the mouth of two or three witnesses, minimum. Doesn't say minimum, but you get the idea that if there's a dozen witnesses that said he killed somebody, well, that would constitute both two and three, and probably several sets more of two and three. So the logic is clear. If you've got two or three, great. If you've got more than two or three, well, you've got at least the two or three. But how about this one? Verse 16 is really key. What if there is an unrighteous witness, a liar? You know, the kind of guy puts his hand on a Bible, says he will do something and has no intention of it. An unrighteous witness, by the way, the Quran says that's perfectly okay, right? It's all for Allah's good. You can lie anywhere you want. Convince those that are not of Islam anyway, just needing death anyway. You can lie all you want. You can bear unrighteous witness against them. That's fine. That's not what the Torah says. So we're clearly talking about another God. Anybody tells you that Allah is the same as the God of the Bible, he too is a liar and the truth is not in him. Understand what Scripture says. He is not speaking on behalf of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh or his word. An unrighteous witness. If he rises up to bear perverted witness against him, well then, how do you know? How do you know who's telling the truth, who's lying? Well, you take both men, between whom is the controversy, they stand before Yahuwah and before the priests and the judges in those days. I guess that would be presuming you had justice, and justices who were actually capable of standing before Yahuwah. Do you kind of see the pattern here? When you've got justices that don't even acknowledge that there is a God. Let me say it bluntly. How the hell would I have anything to do with a justice, a judge, who doesn't even acknowledge the creator of the universe? The man is an idiot. The man does not understand the first elements of the rule of law. The whole concept that there are rights from God, and that he is the one that says, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal. The Bible says that guy is a fool. Why would I possibly accept what any such so-called judge would say? The entire witness of the Torah here is all about righteous judges. People who stand before Yah and know what they're talking about. And understand his word and accept and work diligently to see that it be done. We're talking literally night and day. Well, okay, assuming we had anything even remotely approaching this kind of judge, the idea is that you got two people, there's a controversy, they're both to stand before Yahuwah, no, not Allah, and the priests and the judges that shall be in those days are to inquire diligently and try to determine whether or not the witnesses are, one of them, is a false witness and has testified falsely against his brother. In a lot of cases, that's not as difficult as you might think. Guess what the penalty is? Whatever the false witness was trying to get done to the guy that he was bearing false witness against, Torah says that is what should happen to him. Whatever he had proposed to do to his brother, you are to do that to him. Thus, to put away the evil from the midst of you. I say it one more time. Could you imagine what it would be? Well, some of us actually, at least once upon a time, were a lot closer to a land like that. We knew at least a land where people, even if they didn't do a great job of it all the time, at least some of them tried part of the time. We got people now that try all the time to pervert justice and to destroy anything that the Torah even remotely suggests, and that especially includes the things in the Constitution that were written in accord with it. Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt have honest weights and measures, and so forth and so on. Dishonest witnesses. They're basically supposed to reap what they were trying to sow. Those that remain, who see what happens to dishonest witnesses, you know, the kind of thing, in other words, that the FBI uses routinely to slap convictions on people. I'm going to read a story in just a second here. You're supposed to see and hear and fear so that no more such evil is done in the midst of you. I shall not pity, it says. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. What this is really talking about is measure for measure. As it was weighed out, so shall it be done. It's the same principle as for the unrighteous witness. What he was trying to do to the other guy, measure for measure, that's what should be done to him. Now let me read this story. Here is a second story, also came from the news this afternoon. Listen to this and ask yourself the question, what the hell kind of land are we living in? An unconstitutional agency which should not even exist if we actually still had the rule of law. Remember? The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So, there is a Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms that has no purpose in existence, because shall not be infringed means there's no purpose that anybody who actually, especially, puts their hand on a Bible and purports to, well, be a false witness against this Constitution thing, has no job infringing, by its very existence, that Second Amendment thing. All right. So, you know, that part is already clear. But the ATF announced the development of a new public-private, a.k.a. fascist. Folks, the word public-private partnership means fascism. It is the essence of what that economic theory purports. In other words, you can get around the public law by being private when it suits you. You can get around the private law by being public and getting all the money when it suits you. What a great way to dodge the rule of law. The ATF issued a press release this afternoon. The fight to protect our communities, you know, like from the rule of God, is not just up to law enforcement. It's a partnership between your community and law enforcement. We look to you who live in these communities that we protect. What? We protect you from what? From the rule of law? To provide us with information about gun violence. Well, if the ATF wants information about gun violence, you want info? I'll give you info. There's no such damn thing. There's violence. Whether it's with a knife or a gun or whether it's people that put their hands on the Bible and lie and bear false witness. That kind of violence is punishable by Torah, measure for measure. Gun violence is an idiotic, infantile, anti-constitutional term. So right off the bat, if you look at this press release, you see where they're headed. Here's the point I'm trying to make. ATF is launching a new way to bear false witness against your neighbor. You think I'm kidding? They want tips involving firearms or leads to help us pre-crime, prevent crimes from happening before they even happen. Well, matter of fact, they don't even have to be crimes. You just have to think it might be a crime, and one witness is enough. We don't need two or three witnesses, ha-ha, because we don't have to worry about law anyway. Using your phone, your tablet, your computer, you'll be able to tell us instantly and anonymously about crimes that may or may not be happening in your communities that involve firearms or any of a whole litany of other things, but especially firearms. Listen to this crock. I'm sorry, folks. I read this stuff. I see what goes and what passes for law. I see how the literal rape of the Torah and the Bill of Rights and the supreme law of the land has gone so far that justice, justice you shall pursue, isn't even a distant memory for these lying cretins that swill at the public trough, put their hands on the Bible, at least they used to, and lie. Shall not be infringed. They draw a paycheck for doing exactly that, which the law, if we had it, said shall not be done. Now they're offering people the chance to rat out their neighbors anonymously and instantly. And it doesn't take two or three witnesses. Hell, it doesn't even take one. And no, they don't have a right to face the accuser. Hell, we don't even care who you are. We'll just use your tip to go bust down somebody's door. If we kill somebody in the process, shoot their dog, well, you know, got to break a few eggs to make an omelet and disarm the peons. ATF values your privacy, it says. What a joke. Well, they value your privacy a hell of a lot more than they do your rights or their oaths, obviously. They're offering this service through a new service called Report It, a mobile app that allows you to remain anonymous. You can report suspicious or unusual activities in real time while having the assurance that your identity will remain anonymous and confidential. You can rat out your neighbors without having to worry about being held as an unrighteous witness against your neighbor and bearing perverted witness against anybody. No! The Torah is dead and gone. Stick a fork in it. We have the ATF. What are you going to do about it once we bust down your door after you've been disarmed? What are you going to do? Turn to a God that we don't even acknowledge anymore? You don't have to provide personal information. You can if you feel like it, but it won't be required in order to submit your tip and see your neighbor's door broken down in the middle of the night. The story here goes on to say that there are actually a few people on the internet who worry that this app will become a tool for anti-firearm fanatics to have law-abiding gun owners harassed by federal agents without fear of reprisal for false reporting. What, you think? What we have, says one commenter, is yet another snitch on someone you don't like program. What could possibly go wrong? No chance to confront your accuser. No more worrying about probable cause or even the pretense thereof. No more two or three witnesses, but more agency witch hunts, more selective targeted prosecution, and more of what we've already got run amok. I'm riled up tonight. Yes, you're right, folks, I am. I tend to get riled up anyway when I do this portion, because when I read verses like justice, justice you shall pursue, and I think what the hell it is that is being pursued. What they're pursuing, literally, I use that term specifically, is a hell on earth. Again, if the God of the Bible says do something, they say hell no. If he says we need two or three witnesses, and they had better be honest witnesses, and we're going to put some teeth in the Torah and the instruction to make sure they are honest, what does the ATF say? Well, hell, we're breaking the law anyway. We don't have God-given rights anymore. Our very existence is an abomination before the rule of law, so we're not going to worry about two or three witnesses, or even one, much less whether they're honest or not. We don't care about that. What we care about is any excuse to further rape the rule of law, because justice, justice is the furthest thing from what we want to pursue. Otherwise, how the hell would we have a woman like Hillary Clinton lying through her teeth and committing treason, murder, and you name it? Justice, justice, you shall follow, pursue. We end the portion with this. Now, verse 20. Chapter 20, verse 1. When you go forth to battle against your enemies, and you see a whole bunch of things that are going on, and you're concerned about the battle, the priest is to approach all of these people on the eve of the battle as it draws nigh, and he speaks to them, and he says the following: Hey, hear, O Israel, Shamar, draw nigh this day, y'all are fixing to go into battle against your enemies. Don't let your heart be faint, fear not, or be alarmed, nor be afraid. Excuse me, for it is Yahuwah that goes before you. He goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. And the officers are then to ask the people several questions. This has always been kind of fascinating. They say to the people the following: what man among you has just built a new house? Built a new house, hasn't dedicated it. Don't go out to battle. Come on, go on home, return to his house, lest he might die in battle and another man dedicate his house. Now, this is interesting because I just finished building a vineyard. And having built a vineyard, I have now begun to see that that's quite a project. And there's something really amazing about trying to grow grapes and vines. And it's a multiple-year project. So this struck me as particularly poignant this year. What man is there among you that has planted a vineyard? Kerem hasn't yet used the fruit of it. Him too. Let him go back, return to his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man use the fruit of his vineyard. How about a guy that's got a new wife, hasn't yet taken her? Let him go, return to his house, lest he die in battle, and another man take her. How about the guy who's just plain cowardly? He's fearful, faint-hearted. Go on home. We don't want you. We seek not your comfort nor your arms. That's Sam Adams. And let history forget that ye were our, and let posterity forget that ye were our countrymen. Yeah, this is the kind of guy you don't want among you, says the Torah, because otherwise his contagion might spread. His brethren's heart might melt, as does his. Then, when the officers have made an end of speaking unto the people, the captains of hosts are appointed to head them up, move them out. When you draw nigh to a city to fight against it, here's another one that's interesting. First, you proclaim shalom. You offer it peace. And it shall be, if the answer is yes, peace, and they open their gates to you, well, all the people that are therein, they become tributary to you. They will serve you, but they live. They literally become servants, but they live. But if they will not make peace, instead they choose war, then you besiege them, and when Yahuwah does what is inevitable, delivers them into your hand, this is politically incorrect, isn't it? You smite every male therein with the edge of the sword. They had their choice. They blew it. The women, the little ones, the cattle, all that's in the city, the spoil. The English term is prize. It is taken as prey for yourself. You are to eat the spoil of your enemies, which Yahuwah has given you. Those things, men, women, children, property, they become spoils of war. This is what you're to do to all the cities which are very far off from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. Now, wait a second. What's he saying here? This is a little bit different situation. These nearby ones, these cities, these peoples that are going to be enumerated in just a second that Yahuwah has given you for inheritance, they are in a whole different category. You are to save nothing alive that breathes in them. This is severe. Could the God of the Bible really be saying something like that? Well, the explanation that has become more and more popular, and I got to admit, I think it has a lot of consistency that goes with it. If you go back and you look at the history and you see the stories of the Nephilim and the half-breeds and a whole lot of stuff that essentially says we are talking about a number of peoples here. Here's the list that is to be utterly destroyed. Not a thing that breathes left alive. The Hittites, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. They are pagans, and they may in fact not even be human. They may in fact have genetic material that is no longer part of humanity. That is a tougher case to prove. I can't prove it one way or the other, so I don't teach it as gospel, if you will, or as doctrine, but I do accept that a pretty decent case can be made for it. Is it an absolute ironclad proof? No. Is it what I would call convincing? Yeah, probably so. Even compelling, perhaps. But not a proof, just a firm indication. And clearly, what is being said here in these verses, this part is, I would suggest, not arguable. There is a clear distinction that's being made by the God of the Bible between the peoples that are enumerated, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, and those other peoples that are further off. Oh, but verse 18 is also clear and furthermore consistent, and we've seen this before too. So that they do not teach you to do after their abominations, the thing they've done unto their gods, so that you might sin against Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, your Elohim. And guess what? Seems to me like we got a whole lot of that going on in America. Maybe there's a bunch of Hivites and Hittites and Amorites and Perizzites and Canaanites infesting this land too. Hard to say, but one thing is clear, there's a whole lot of worshiping of other gods going on. As a matter of fact, just about the only God that is absolutely verboten, certainly in the schools and in the halls of Congress and for crying out loud, the Oval Office, is the God of the Bible. A couple other, interesting admonishments that close out the chapter. When you besiege a city, don't destroy the trees, at least not the trees that produce edible fruit. Don't cut them down. For what is the tree of the field? Is it a man that it should be besieged by you? Only trees that you know are not food trees. Those you can destroy and cut down so that you can make bulwarks against the city that makes war with you until it falls. In other words, use that as war material. But food trees, leave them. Now finally, chapter 21 lays out something which is at the same time interesting and maybe even a little bit scary for folks. I think it's the scary part of this that I want to emphasize for a second. Actually, the word that Rashi uses, or at least translated into English, is outrage. And if you haven't gotten the impression already, as I go through the Torah portion here, Shoftim, and see justice, justice you shall pursue, I think there is a lot of outrage. Certainly, I feel it. You probably gathered that. Chapter 21 says following, if you found a dead body, someone who has been slain in the land which you go in to possess, there's a guy or a person just out there lying in the field, and we don't know what happened to the poor fellow, who has whacked him. Well, then the elders and the judges are to come forth, and they're to measure the distances to the nearest metro area, the nearest cities, around the person who's slain. They say, okay, look, this one's about, 4 leagues away. That one's 2 leagues away, and the other one is 20 leagues away. Here's the closest city. So the nearest city to the slain man, even the elders of that city, are now to go take a heifer from the herd. It's a heifer which has not been drawn in the yoke. In other words, this is kind of similar to the red heifer. It has not been yoked. The elders of the city bring this poor little heifer down to a rough valley which is neither plowed nor sown, and they break this poor heifer's neck right there in the valley. So we got a dead body. We don't know who done it. We don't know what the situation is. The elders come from the nearest town. They bring this poor little, as it turns out, Eglah Arufa, the heifer whose neck is broken. And they do that to it. Priests, sons of Levi, come near, those that Yahuwah has chosen to minister unto him and to bless in the name of Yahuwah. And according to their word shall every controversy and every stroke be. The elders of the city, also, the ones nearest to the slain man, all of them wash their hands over the Eglah Arufa, the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. And they say the following, quote, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. Forgive, O Yahuwah, your people Israel, whom you have redeemed. Do not suffer innocent blood to remain in the midst of your people Israel, and this blood shall be forgiven them. I'm going to read the last verse in the Parsha in a second, but I want to go back to this commentary about the elders, and they speak these words after they washed their hands over this poor innocent heifer whose neck was broken, the Eglah Arufa. And the way Rashi puts it is this, and basically what he does is a word analysis on the Eglah Arufa and the things that they say. And essentially, the phrase is really, really key. Says, our hands have not shed this blood. And furthermore, our eyes haven't seen it. I compare very briefly. Look what's going on in America today, right? We're ignorant of anything that might be a real crime. We turn our eyes away from criminality if it's, somebody that's running for president that's above the law, or if it's somebody who's supposed to enforce the law but in fact rapes it in order to draw a paycheck and oppresses people in violation of what was once called the supreme law of the land. No, we turn a blind eye to that. We're willing to let so-called law enforcement break down doors for things that are not crimes, kill people's dogs, maybe shoot a few innocents along the way. Hey, no big deal there. They're just peons anyway. But these folks are supposed to go out in the field where there is a dead body that just happens to be close to their city and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen it. In other words, the way Rashi puts it is, let's be clear. Not even indirectly are they responsible for the death of this poor stranger. Because you know what? Torah also tells us we're supposed to take care of the stranger. One law. Justice, justice you shall pursue. One law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. Sodom and Gomorrah, folks. Yeah, there was sodomy going on there. Yeah, there was a whole lot of other stuff. But you know what the sages say? The real nastiness of Sodom and Gomorrah was they mistreated the strangers. The way the United States of America and indeed the whole world now mistreats its own citizenry. These folks have committed an outrage on this poor Eglah Arufa, breaking its neck, and over it they say, look, we are supposed to take care of the stranger. How could this have happened in a place where we're supposed to take care of the stranger? So no, even indirectly, we didn't see this. Our hands have not shed this blood, nor our eyes seen it. In other words, we are declaring that this happened in spite of our efforts, because we know the Torah. Forgive, O Yahuwah, your people, because you have redeemed them, that's us, and do not suffer innocent blood to remain in the midst of your people Israel. Folks, we revel as a nation in the blood of the innocents, and in the rape of literally everything that was once called justice, justice you shall pursue. It infuriates me, I'll admit it. It infuriates me. I read Ezekiel 8 and 9 about the abominations that are being done. I see those men that are marked because they sigh and cry at the abominations. Folks, we ought to be sighing and crying at the abominations. We need to be looking at what's going on in Washington and in New York City and on Main Street all over the place and saying, for crying out loud, what a bunch of abominations! What the hell has happened to the rule of law? two or three witnesses. No, the ATF will break down your door because some idiot that doesn't know what shall not be infringed means says, I saw a guy with a gun. I think you better go break down his door. If you kill him, okay. The Torah says those persons are deserving of exactly that which they are trying to bring upon their neighbor by their unrighteous witness. And that's the little stuff that's going on. The portion ends with this. So, you shall put away the innocent blood from the midst of you, when you shall do that which is right in the eyes of Yahuwah. I mean, seriously, what else is there to say at a time like this? Would it be so? May we live to see justice, justice actually being pursued in the land. May we be regathered. May He protect us from those who not only do not do righteousness, but hate Yahuwah, our Elohim, and everything that He stands for and all of His word. And may we seek to follow Him. Amen.